everybody.
Good morning.
My name is Shoichi Iwasaki. I'm from UCLA, and I will moderate this workshop. First of all, I want you to take a look at the map. The Jeju Island goes to, the southern part of the Korean Peninsula goes to Fukuoka, that's Japan, and the Ryukyu Islands between Taipei and Kagoshima. So we are looking at the situations in Jeju in Korea and the Ryukyu Island in Japan. First of all, I'd like to thank ICLDC organizers and National Science Foundation and Toyota Grant, which made this meeting possible. And our team, starting with Professor William O'Grady from UH, Professor Chang Yong Yang from Jeju. Oh, we'll do that now. Oh, okay. Okay. Professor O'Grady from UH. And Chang Yong Yang, Professor Chang Yong Yang from Jeju National University. And Sejong Yang is a UH graduate student. She's actually working in Jeju Island now, so she will participate from with a video later. And next is Professor Yukinori Takubo, Kyoto University Emeritus Professor, and also a new Director of National Institute of Japanese Language and Linguistics. And Dr. Masahiro Yamada, he's a researcher at National Institute of Japanese Language and Linguistics. And finally, Mr. Hiroyuki Nakama, he's a former principal of Miyako High School. Okay, so we are a big group. And we have a lot of things to do in the next 90 minutes, so let's get it started. There are many different reasons why languages become endangered. One reason is the central government's attempt to create a myth by labeling minority languages as dialects of the standard language of the nation, and the subsequent acceptance of such a myth by the speakers of those so-called dialects. In this workshop, we'll look at such a condition that happened in the Ryukyu Islands in Japan and Jeju Island in Korea. We will first look at the situation from the speaker's perspective in a talk story fashion and attempt to understand the psychological effect that speakers may have experienced. In the second part of the workshop, we discuss how linguists can contribute to dispel such a myth. That's okay, And so we'll discuss how linguists can contribute to dismiss such a myth by proposing some objective measurement to gauge the degrees of mutual intelligibility between the so-called dialects and the central standard language. And the measurement is important as mutual unintelligibility is one crucial factor to establish a linguistic system as an independent language. So first, I will ask Professor Grady to discuss the Jeju situation with his colleagues, and then I will introduce a speaker from one of the Ryukyu Islands. And after we learn about the language situations and speakers' experiences, I will ask Jeju team to talk about the mutual intelligibility measurement tool and how it was created and how it was implemented. Then the Ryukyu team will explain how they have adopted the measurement tool when multiple languages are involved. And after each section, we'll pause so that you can ask us questions. But I like to wait until the end of the whole presentation for more substantial discussion. But you're welcome to ask any questions that pertain to the particular segment of our workshop. Okay, so Professor Brady.
Thank you all for being here. I'd like to begin my remarks by talking a little bit about the contrast between language and dialect, which is familiar to many linguists, but not necessarily to people who do not have formal training in linguistics. Now, for linguists, a dialect is simply a distinct variety of a particular language. And what makes the dialect distinct, it could be lexical, you know, choice of vocabulary. It could be something phonological, something morphosyntactic, or any combination thereof. And many languages, especially those with a large population or a large area, have multiple dialects. So there's absolutely nothing unusual about there being dialects for any particular language. But here's what happens over time. If there's isolation between the groups speaking the different dialects, the differences among the dialects can increase, ultimately creating new languages. And of course, that's the story of languages in Europe. And there was once a sort of a Germanic language from which, over time, different dialects differentiated to the point where there came to be a German and a Dutch and an English and a Norwegian and a Danish and so on. Same thing, of course, for the Romance languages. It started with Latin. Different varieties of Latin developed in different parts of Europe. Over time, they became different enough from each other so that we started recognizing them as different languages, French and Spanish and Italian and Portuguese and so forth. Now, some languages, unfortunately, never get the recognition that they deserve. They continue to be treated as dialects simply because they happen to be related to some other language in the area. And the misclassification of a language as a dialect, especially a non-standard dialect, of another language has negative consequences. There are emotional and psychological consequences, for example. An important cultural practice in your community, namely your language, is devalued by outsiders who treat it as a minor or aberrant or less successful version of a more standard language or dialect, cultural practice. That cannot be a pleasant experience to be put in that position. There are also practical consequences. If your variety happens to be endangered, funding and enthusiasm to preserve a dialect is typically lower than for preserving an actual language. And the end result, of course, of this misclassification of a language as a dialect is that it is, over time, used less and less. People are less and less proud of it, and eventually it's no longer used at all. Two situations in which there's this sort of dialect label overuse are worth drawing attention to. One is when you have multiple related indigenous languages. And they can end up being grouped together as sort of dialects of each other, whereas in fact they may be quite different languages. And we see this situation especially in North and South America. It's well known, for example, that in Mexico there are a variety of language families like the Chinantec and Mixtec and Zapotec, in which the members of the families are often treated as just dialects of each other, even though on closer inspection they turn out to be different enough from each other to merit the language label. And the second situation, which we want to concentrate on here, is where you have a language that is related to the dominant language in the region and ends up being classified as a dialect of that language. And the two case studies that we're going to focus on here involve Jeju in Korea and the Ryukyuan languages in Japan. Now, Jaja is a critically endangered language, according to the UNESCO report from 2010. The only fluent speakers are elderly in their 70s and older, and there are no more than 5,000 fluent speakers on the island with a population of 600,000. So you see there's critical endangerment there. And within Korea, Jaja is widely considered to be a very unique but non-prestige dialect of Korean. And many residents of Jeju Island feel uncomfortable using Jeju in public, and they're unaware of the importance of preserving the language. Now we're going to have Dr. Sang-yong Yang, who is a professor in the College of Education at Jeju National University and the leader of the Jeju Revitalization Movement, talk to us about what it was like when he was younger growing up on Jeju Island with the sorts of attitudes that were prevalent at that time about Jeju.
Okay, thanks, William. Good morning, everyone. My name is Chang-yong from Jeju, actually. I'm speaking my native language, Jeju. The language of Jeju is called Jeju. You know, briefly, William talks about the situation, linguistic situation of Jeju. And to get a better understanding of Jeju, I'd like to talk about the memories, actually, collections, you know, growing up, and then. I'd like to add more attitude and policies in relating to Jeju, the current situation of Jeju in Jeju. Locations I skip at this part, you know, in the center of the park is Jeju located. And look at this island, this green part is a mountainous area. Jeju Island has the highest mountain in Korea, South Korea. And this means the mountains, you know, divide into northern part and southern part. And then even though in the northern part, this will be northern part and this will be southern part. Actually, I was born in these areas. In the northern part, there's some kind of contact with the mainland, but southern part is totally, you know, separated from the mainland. This is kind of the, you know, geographical situation of Jeju. Then talking about the language, that means you better understanding the history of the Korean, the 1945, the 45 liberation from the Japanese occupation, then followed by the Korean Civil Wars in 3 years. Then actually, you know, the new governments was introduced in 1950s. They tried to establish new national curriculums, centralizing the government powers. Then what happened in 1950s? Why 1950s is a period, this kind of a significant period in Jeju. Before 1950s, Jeju is kind of isolated places, not that frequent countries, mainland. But after Korean War and, you know, period of 1950s, people from the mainland moved to Jeju. That means, you know, Senate Korean spread around Jeju for the first time in history. Well, I'm using that for the first time. You know, it's really widely spread around in Jeju. Then means, you know, local Jeju community into bilingual the society in 1950s. Then followed in 1960s and 70s. You know, governments tried to focus on economic developments, modernizing social system in Korea. We are focusing on three parts: standardization, industrialization, and emphasis on education. By standardization means, you know, to get rid of local diversity, and industrialization means, you know, is changing the agriculture-based social system into more modern systems. Then, and finally, I talk about the, you know, language situations about the teachers, the based on my memories. I was born, as I told you, in the rural areas in southern part of Jeju, in Red isolated. That means, you know, when I was born, you know, the late 60s, and you know, well, actually, there was no the electricity, and then the transportation system is very limited. The buses are, you know, long or less than five times a day. You know, that means, ironically, that means, you know, contributing, maintaining of Jeju. Then this is kind of the key parts I'm talking about today. Then what happened when I was at the school, I mean elementary and the junior high school. You know, Jeju actually is not allowed in school because of the central government force, you know, the school and the every local schools use standard Korean because, you know, that is the one best way to unify the nations. You know, after, you know, just after, you know, going through the suffering of the Korean War and other social turmoils, then that means that Korean is the only language of instructions. And you see, if teacher used Jeju in class, he was reprimanded by principals or local ministry of education. Then what happened? Students used Jeju, they received a reprimand from the teachers. You know, then, in the worst case, you know, real students who used Jeju at school were even subject to corporal punishment. You know, corporal punishment plus, you know, cleaning their classroom, something like that. You know. Then what happened? What my parents or neighbors saying about Jeju in when I grew up? Well, when I grew up, the Jeju is very, you know, it's a the language at home and local community. But you see here, you know, my parents wanted their kids to use standard Korean, you know, for example, to get a decent job, so, you know, to get a pass through the, you know, the national test, something like that. Then what happened here is, you know, people, they used Jeju viewed favorably by others in the communities. Well, these days means, you know, after 2000, you know, Jeju should be, they, many people thought the case should be preserved because it's very unique, you know, because it's very distinct from the other the local languages. Then still it's not felt to be appropriate to use Jeju in public or at one's place, you know, of work. That means what? Well, the use of pure Jeju is not favored by people in the, you know, local community. But good news is that, you know, there is some movement. You know, this is, you know, by recognition of Jeju, by the recognition of Jeju at the UNESCO or, you know, some scholarly works, a little bit change. And this happens, you know, around the Jeju. These are, you know, some good things. Then people on Jeju Islands ashamed of their languages. Well, you know, it's not easy to know whether people on Jeju were ashamed or their language. But one sure thing is that they are, you know, they are not proud of their languages. This moment, this is. You know, there are two reasons for this. One is a central government's policy, of, you know, as I mentioned, centralization and standardization. Also, you know, local people avoid using Jeju to hide their identity. You know, why they try to hide their identity. There is some historical time if they use Jeju. They may be resistance or, you know, discriminate against, you know, there's some really the hard time just after liberation before Korean War. It called, you know, Jeju uprising. One third of Jeju people you know, were killed because of that event. You know, this is kind of very, you know, harsh moment in Jeju history. Then I briefly talk about etiquette at this moment with these two questions. First one is, if you have the chances, I want to involve in civic activity that contributed to the preservation of Jeju, or in what ways should Korean and Jeju be used for everyday communications? The result is, you know, very active involved in, you know, about 10%, or the other side, the opposite is not that much involved in, you know, it's more doubled, you know, about 20%. Yeah, well, this kind of attitude at this moment, but they weren't Korean or Jeju. Well, the highest percentage go to, you know, it doesn't matter which language is used. Well, I just try to interpret this response as a good, you know, signal. Okay, if we make some efforts, people we can change the attitude, you know, the intriguing to use Jeju in the future. Then because time limit, I better skip this part, and I try to, this is my final question and answer. Then now, there is no evidence that Jeju is an independent language. Can this information be used to improve the status of Jeju, to enhance island pride in their history and culture, and influence the national government's language policies? Yes, you know, good news is that people have come to will recognize the importance of locality and diversity. You know, is a because of some, there's a, as I briefly mentioned, there's a movement. You know, we try to change in our attitude. You know, then the question of whether Jeju is an independent language was not a concern of local people or local government. You know, government is just symbolically, okay, this is important, you know, they might go, not that, you know, they do not take real action yet. Also, they just recognize that language spoken in Jeju very different from the ones spoken in other areas, you know. But however, the recent recognition of Jeju as an independent language boost local people's attitude about their languages. Then finally, you know, but also it's also enhance our land pride in their culture and history. This is final things, but however, it has not been noticed yet that independence of Jeju has any influence on national government language policy. You know, still, you know, we're talking about the Jeju on my islands. Because, you know, there are some civic movements, you know, it forced local government, okay, you better provide some, you know, some the language policy to preserve, you know, our cultures, our languages, our uniqueness of Jeju. You know, there is a still, you know, this kind of local movement, but it has yet reached, you know, local the national levels. Hopefully, you know, it can. Latest. Okay, this is my brief introduction about the Jeju situations. You know, we'll continue the video clips on 19th, you know, experience.
Thank you, Sean. Okay. I'd like now to play you a short video. It was prepared by Sejong Yang, who's a PhD student in our department here, and she's going to recount her experiences growing up on Jeju Island. As a, I want to go back up.
The other direction.
There we go. And how do I get her started? Just
click on it, or if it doesn't work.
Okay. It worked before we came down here, needless to say.
You can probably exit out of this.
Okay, let me exit out and get it from my head. Let's see if that works. There we go.
teachers, but used a mixture of Jejuwa and Korean to friends and family. I remember that if a student spoke in Jejuwa to teachers, some teachers would gently remind the student to use standard Korean, but some harsh teachers would hit the student on the head and say, "You are so rude. How dare you speak Saturi, which means dialect, to your teacher?" I went to a girls' high school where there were some girls from rural area who spoke more Jejuwa than girls who grew up in the city like me. And some teachers teased them by saying, "How can a young lady speak Saturi so much? You should speak like a real lady." I believe that those comments by teachers reinforced our perception of Jejuwa as rude and non-feminine. Our research team revealed a very important fact that Jejuwa is not intelligible to monolingual Korean speakers. The intelligibility rate was only between 6% to 10%. The finding itself was not very interesting, to be honest with you, because that fact has been talked widely on the island all the time, but no one has carried out a real experiment on it until now. However, the most incredible outcome of the research at a personal level was that it made me think about my identity deeply for the very first time. I asked myself, what does it mean that Jejuwa is not intelligible to others? And it is possible to say that it is an independent language by the standards of modern linguistics. But what will change because of this fact? It has been 3 years since I asked that question, and now I have one answer to it. After all, I didn't have to abandon Jejuwa at all. Actually, I had the choice of keeping both Korean and Jejuwa. But no one actually told me that it is okay to have both languages. It is actually a gift that you can speak another language naturally from the birth. Ever since I started working on Jejuwa, many things happened to me. One of them is that for the very first time, I missed my grandparents very much. I had a very close relationship with my grandparents when I was very little, but as soon as I started my school, I hardly met them. Now I miss them very much, because I have so many questions that I want to ask them. Not about only Jeju, but also I want to ask them about the history of Jeju Island and also their life experiences. I've heard from many elderly Jeju speakers that their grandchildren don't understand what they are saying. And I also hear from younger speakers that they don't understand what their grandparents are saying. Jejuwa is the chain that connects the young and old generation. Jeju Island has changed so much over the past few decades. There are more outsiders than Jeju locals now, and at the same time, we're losing our unique lifestyle really fast. I'm nervous about what will happen to our language and our culture in the near future. I'm even more afraid when I think about where we will live and what we will do, because there are many communities where people lost their language as well as their lands. Is Jeju Island following their footsteps? Now that we have the evidence that Jejuwa is an independent language, will it make a difference to Jeju society? The majority of people are still unaware of this finding, and I wonder how ordinary Jeju people will perceive it. I'm sure that it will play an important role in helping Jeju people realize the importance of Jejuwa. However, the long-term problem that we have been facing is that information and the facts of this type are not taught directly in the school system in a timely manner. Because the national school curriculum uses the same textbooks everywhere in the country, and Jeju students don't have a chance to learn much about Jeju culture, history, and language. We haven't been given enough information and time to understand who we really are and to build pride in our history, culture, and language from the bottom of our hearts. I doubt that the single fact that Jejuwa is an independent language can influence the national government's language policy unless we Jeju locals argue that Jejuwa is part of the unique Jeju culture which completes who we really are.
That was a perspective of a younger resident of the Jeju Island. At this point, I think I'm going to stop here, and you're going to call for some possible questions.
So if you have some questions regarding Jeju situation, we have pause a couple minutes here. Okay.
So,
William,
saying,
can you?
Are you? Is there an implication here that because it's on the move to be recognized as an independent language, that maybe to further this along is to officialize it as a official language along with standard Korean?
Chang-young, I think you should answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is too much, to talking about the official language, levels, it's not, it's not that we did not think about the level yet, but what we are trying to is that, we try to, make people in Korea recognize, they might get the Jeju. People in Korea, they admit, Jeju is very unique, they don't understand. That's all. Then just call it dialect. Like that means dialect means a little bit, so the kind of attitude look down the local people. That means you try to insist that Jeju is unique. That means it's linguistically through the experiments. It's an independent language. We try to it is not that look down. The situations, it is equal opportunity, Korean and the Jeju. So officially we are in the publicly we just urge them to use the Jeju, but in the private levels or local levels we try to use them and then try to keep the language alive and going down. So I don't know, much later if we have a strong background, Jeju is independent language, the chances that maybe official, we gain the status of official the language in Korea. So well, this are maybe later we are talking about.
Okay, one more question.
Wanted to comment that I agree that when you misclassify or you devalue a dialect and say it, you don't recognize it as language, does has ramifications. I agree that it's like that in Canada, in British Columbia, one of our provinces have the most languages in all of Canada. So who does the classifying of the language in your where you're from?
Yeah, I think the National Institute for Korean Language decides. Right?
You mean the language classified as a dialect?
Yeah, who classifies it?
They classify as a dialect or individual?
Yeah.
Well, this central government, there is a National Institute of Korean. Yeah, they call they are they institute work for the languages. To not just work for the standard Korean. Then they try to make our national curriculums.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they try to this is for the education purposes. But then only focus on the standard Korean. Not that much attention to other local languages. Just calling as a dialect.
We have one more question. Okay.
Yeah. How much influence or change has happened with the Japanese occupation of Korea between the standard Korean and Jejuan?
Well, there is a good question, but I noticed that there is some article about the influence of Japanese and influence of the Mongolian, but some still in Korean, some very wide range of vocabulary used from Japanese and Mongolian, but I don't know how many percentage of influence in the influence on the Korean language, but most of the vocabulary, especially the construction, the words, terms, technical terms for the construction areas, still Japanese words are used a lot, but there's some vocabulary there, but I'm not quite sure how much.
I know that there's several more hands, but to interest of time, I want to move on, and we can still have time for general questions later. Okay. Okay. So we heard the experience from Jeju speakers. And I'll move on to talk about Liu Qiyuan situation. And before I ask our speaker from Miyako Island to talk about his experience, I'd like to give some brief outline of the historical background surrounding Liu Qiyuan languages. Liu Qiyuan refers to the island chain, as you saw in the map earlier, roughly between Kyushu of Japan and Taiwan. And UNESCO identified 6 independent languages in this region, and these languages are mutually unintelligible. And there's especially a large gap between varieties found in the northern islands and those found in the southern island. Since the 14th century, these islands were under the control of the Ryukyu Kingdom, which flourished as a key location for maritime trading between Japan, China, and many different ports in Southeast Asia. In the 16th and 17th centuries, a unique culture emerged, including an important famous anthology of local poems called Omorososhi. But the kingdom was gradually losing its vitality, partly due to invasion from the Satsuma troops from Japan. And in the mid-19th century, it was absorbed by the newly establishing Japanese government. And this is the beginning of central language policy adopted by the Japanese government. And the next 100 years, most speakers of different Ryukyuan languages became bilingual between their own language and Japanese. The language shift was accelerated during and after the Pacific War, and now the shift is almost complete. However, the linguists can still work with native speakers, and we are fortunate enough to find willing and passionate language teachers in many parts of the Ryukyu. Mr. Hiroyuki Nakama is one of such teachers. And he was born in 1947 in a small village called Nishihara on the Miyako Island, and grew up there. And he was a monolingual Ikema speaker as a child, but gradually became bilingual between Japanese and his native language. And he received university education in the main island of Okinawa and became a high school teacher for physics and math. His last position before he retired was the principal of Miyako High School, his alma mater. He's very knowledgeable of history and culture of his village, and a very passionate language teacher. Though he now lives in the main island of Okinawa, he always comes back to Miyako Island whenever we go to visit his village. I said he was a bilingual, but actually he was a trilingual because he can speak also English. So we are very fortunate to have him so that we can hear his experience through his own voice. So that's what we are going to ask Mr. Nakama. So please welcome Mr. Nakama from Miyako Island.
Tautio tabi hainu. I felt Hawaiian holy and spiritual song is like my island's song, holy and spiritual song. And I sang today. And this song continues in 2 hours or more. Okay, hello friends. Thank you for your kind invitation. My English is very, very poor, so I'm going to read my composition, okay? This is the first time for me to come to Hawaii. My name is Hiroyuki Nakama, N-A-K-A-M-A. Nakama means companion in English. Even when I'm alone, I am a companion. But from the moment, we are companions. By the way, my native country, my island is near Taiwan and the Philippines. There are several languages on the island, and they are like Japanese. If we make phonological changes over my direct words, we can find Japanese words in the Japanese dictionary in many cases. Second, the crisis of dialect and the dialect tag. Dialect tag is like this. I'd like to talk about crisis of language in my village. About 60 years ago, when I was a little boy, most of the people in my village spoke only in the dialect. When I was a little baby, my mom died. And I was raised by grandma, who could not speak and understand Japanese because she didn't have any school education. Our communication was in the dialect. But I had to learn Japanese when I entered elementary school. It was not easy to have conversation in new language, and school in Okinawa made dialect tag, like this size. If a student spoke their dialect, he or she had to hang the dialect tag around their neck until he or she found the next student who spoke the dialect. And if he couldn't find the next student, he had to wear it whole day. And he or she had to clean the classroom after school too. It's kind of systematic bullying in school education. During World War II, if a person spoke the dialect in front of Japanese soldiers, he was doubted as a spy. I heard rumors that many Okinawans were killed because of this. Anyway, there was strong language control by the government in Okinawa until the war ended in 1945. I think it's very important to speak, read, and write Japanese in school education. But on the other hand, Okinawan people were losing their dialect, it is said that to lose language is to lose the culture. I believe it's very important to keep the language and culture that are fundamental for our identity. Why we couldn't conserve the dialect? There are several reasons. First, if a person speaks in the dialect in public, he or she would be considered uneducated. This is still continuing even now. So many people do not want to talk in the dialect in public. The people are gradually losing their dialect. And on the other hand, they can speak more easily in Japanese. Therefore, many people cannot speak in the dialect fluently. Today, the government is encouraging us to conserve the dialects, but it's very hard. I was teaching my dialect at the Prefectural Museum in Naha, in Okinawa, for 5 years as Okinawan government project, but the number of students were very, very small. Majority of people are not interested in it. Second reason is interchange of people. 55 years ago, when I was a student at Miyake High School, the students spoke in their own dialects. However, it was getting easier for people to go to other village by modern transportation, so that they needed a common language, I mean Japanese. When I was Miyake High School principal, between 2004 and 2007, the students spoke Japanese naturally, and they don't even know easy words in the dialect, such as eyes, face, hands, feet, nails, ears, and so on. I would say they have lost the dialect. In the old day, the people used to get married to someone in the same village, but it is very different nowadays. We have many brides and bridegrooms from other areas. We need common language for communication. Of course, it's Japanese, not the dialect. Nowadays, the grandpa and grandma almost never speak to the bride, bridegroom, and grandchildren in the dialect. It's, of course, Japanese. The third reason is mass communication. We can watch TVs and read newspapers and so on every day. We have a lot of opportunities to learn Japanese, but not the dialect. The fourth reason is globalization. We now live in internationalized and computerized era. We need to use the common major language, Japanese or English. Why do many people want to learn English in the world? You know, US is a powerful and richest nation in the world. So worldwide activities depend on the major language. And the President Trump always says, we will make America great again. Thank you for my listening, my speech.
Okay, so I'll take again a couple of short questions now before we move on to the next section.
How important are you have your traditional song?
Yeah, yes, I Yes, I have a lot of traditional song.
And did your the generation after you
learned them?
あの先生のこの歌トラディショナルソングが、
はい、
あの世代を超えて、
ああ違う、
うん、継承されていますか
って違う違うそんなことはない、うん、今僕らだけでグループを作って歌っています、yeah.
They have their own singing group with his friends and they sing a song but unfortunately it was not it's not being transmitted to our younger generations
あの翻訳もしてるってですねこの
Yeah, and Ms. Nakama has been translating old song into Japanese. Yes.
Okay. That was my question. So I'm from also a community kind of similar. We have more like a passive assimilation. So I was thinking like, what are your next steps understanding and like kind of regain some of this lost pride and confidence? So I was just wondering what are the next steps
ネクステップは先生これからどうしたらよろしいでしょうかってその言語とかねあの文化を継承していくために
やっぱし DVD とか論文で残すしかないんじゃないですか、
So his suggestion is to record our, the current situation, you know, the language as currently still used by older generationsAnd linguist research is really a big help in his opinion. Okay, so I'd like to again ask William to talk about the experimental part of this workshop.
Is that working? So you wanted to, this one? This one. Okay. So we might want to call this part of the talk Linguistics Strikes Back. There's a political game going on in many countries, and it involves the idea that you have you know, one nation and one language, and everything else has to be a dialect. But we linguists know better. We have a principled approach to the question of languagehood. And the criterion that we linguists use for defining languagehood involves mutual intelligibility. The way to distinguish between dialects and languages is to examine their mutual comprehensibility. That is, can speakers from one place, say, Jeju Island or the Ryukyus, be understood by people from another, and vice versa. If speakers from two different places can understand each other, then typically we say they speak dialects or varieties of the same language. If they cannot understand each other, however, then we say they speak different languages. Now, there are many different methods that have been used over the decades to assess intelligibility. Some of them involve something as simple as anecdotal reports. I was down there last weekend and I couldn't understand anything anyone said to me. And there are also subjective judgments by people who are familiar with both varieties of speech. Oh, they're really different. I don't think they're the same. There are also measurements of similarity, such as the proportion of cognates in the lexicons or vocabularies of the two languages. That at least has the merit of being somewhat objective rather than just anecdotal or subjective. Linguistic tests that have been devised over the years typically focus on the comprehension of written or spoken words or sentences or discourse. Now, the focus of our work is on the spoken language, and it's on the spoken language as it's used in sort of a narrative context. And the reason for that is this. Someone could say a single word to you from a language that you didn't actually speak very well at all, and you might well understand it. The real test for comprehensibility the gold standard at least, is that you can understand when people speak to you in a series of sentences. They tell you a story, can you understand it or not? So here's our question. Is Jejuo comprehensible to people who speak only Korean? If it is, then Jejuo would be a dialect of Korean. And if it isn't comprehensible to people who speak only Korean, then it would qualify as an independent language by the linguistic criterion of intelligibility. So we did an experiment that involved, as you can see, 53 participants, aged 49 to 60. They came from different parts of Korea. 23 of them were from the Seoul area, which is where the standard national variety of Korean is spoken. There were 10 from Yeosu, which is in the southwestern corner of the Korean Peninsula, or the south central portion of the Korean Peninsula. And there were 10 from Busan, in the southeast corner of the Korean Peninsula. And finally, there were 10 residents of Jeju Island. And we created a narrative that was a little over a minute long, describing a series of connected events from what's sometimes called the pear story. It's a video that depicts a man going up a ladder to pick pears from the tree, and various things happen, mishaps, and so on. Very basic vocabulary, and simple syntactic structures suffice to describe what happens in the video. So we had two native speakers of Jejuo describe the video as they watched it. We transcribed their descriptions, and then we merged the two descriptions into a single narrative script. One of the speakers, a female, then read the merged narrative, which was recorded. Now, participants in the intelligibility study from those four places in Korea listened to the entire narrative without interruption, a little over a minute long. And they didn't see the video, of course. They didn't know what was being described. They had to rely solely on the narrative, the oral narrative, to figure out what was being described. Then we broke the recording down into five segments, and we played each segment one at a time. And each segment was accompanied by a comprehension question in Korean, because everyone was a Korean speakers. So I'm just going to give you the English version of this. The first segment was, a rooster is crowing in the distance. A man is picking pears by himself. Some pears fall to the ground. So that's the equivalent was said in Jeju. And at the end of that segment, three comprehension questions were asked in Korean. The first was, what kind of noise was described at the beginning of the story? Remember? The rooster, right? How many people are in the story up to this point? There's a man, right? And what's the man in the story doing? Picking pears, right? Okay, that's good evidence you guys understood English. But see, that's the point. If it was in Jeju, would you be able to understand? Well, here are the results of the study. Correct responses for the comprehension questions overall for the entire five segments. As you can see, the native speakers, the Jejuo native speakers living on Jeju Island, they responded correctly about 90% of the time. They did darn well. On the other hand, the speakers in Seoul, less than 10% correct. In Yeosu, which is actually much closer to Jeju Island than Seoul is, they only got 6% correct. And Busan just over 6% correct as well. Well, that's a pretty big difference, isn't it? But there was more. We also decided that we would simultaneously conduct a self-assessment survey as the experiment was ongoing. And the idea here was to have the participants in the experiment rate themselves on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 would be, I don't understand anything. Right? And 10 would be, I understand everything. And in between, well, I understand quite a bit. And we gave the participants three opportunities to assess how things were going. Well, one was right before the study began. They were asked, well, tell us where you think you are in terms of your ability to understand Jejuo. And then right after they heard the narrative for the first time, they were asked again to self-assess. And then finally, after they had tried to answer the comprehension questions, they were given one last chance to assess themselves in terms of their ability to understand Jejuo. So So there are your results. You see that the Jeju Islanders were pretty confident from the very beginning that they were going to understand about just about everything. They said, oh, 8 out of 10. And that was borne out. In fact, at the end, they actually rated themselves even higher, 8.3 out of 10. But you see, the Seoul and the Yasu and the Busan speakers, even at the outset, they had pretty serious doubt because they'd heard bits and pieces of Jeju over the years on TV. It often shows up in the soap operas. They set the soap operas in Jeju Island for an exotic effect, and they throw in a little bit of Jeju so people will make feel that it's authentic. And they realize they can't understand it. So they already realized this was not going to be easy. They gave themselves low scores. But by the time it was over, they're giving themselves scores less than 1 out of 10, right, on a scale of 0 to 10, in terms of their ability to understand what they had just heard. This is a huge difference, too, as you can see. So the conclusion would be that Jeju is so different from Korean that it cannot be understood by people who speak only Korean. Therefore, by the standards of contemporary linguistics, to which I think we all adhere, it should be recognized as an independent language. And there would be not a single language in Korea, there'd be a family, a Koreanic language family, with two members, Korean and Jeju. And it's also simple and makes so much sense, and it's wonderful as a linguist to be able to contribute to social policy in that way. But not so fast. There are doubters. In fact, I could name a linguist, a Korean linguist right now, whose name would be familiar to many of you, who said to me, well, William, this must have been fun for you. But these are just numbers, and you know, we have feelings about our language, and we know there's only one language in Korea. And so the part about these are just numbers struck home for me, and I realized that we do need to ask the question, how do you interpret low scores like this and low self-assessments like the ones we found? Are they really indicative of languagehood? And what was missing from the study was what one would call a baseline. Baseline would involve starting out with a couple of languages about which there is no uncertainty and no controversy as to their languagehood. You know, these are two distinct languages, right? And then do the study with those two distinct languages related distinct languages and see how that comes out. So that's what we set out to do with the help of Nana Hilton, a linguist in Holland. We decided to take a Dutch and Norwegian. And the reason we took those two languages is that like Jeju and Korean, in our view, they are closely related to each other, both Germanic languages, but they're Dutch and Norwegian are uncontroversially recognized as distinct languages. So we took, we had 28 native speakers of Dutch who had never studied Norwegian and never lived in Norway. And we made up a Norwegian pair story narrative parallel to the one that we had for Jeju. And we used the same method as in the Jeju study. They heard the whole narrative, the Dutch speakers heard the whole Norwegian narrative first. Then it was broken down into segments. And after each segment, they were asked comprehension questions. And the results were interesting. The mean comprehension rate for the Dutch speakers who were listening to Norwegian was 9.89%. In other words, it fell into just the same range as the scores for Koreans who were learning or who were trying to understand Jeju. Remember, that was around 6.9% to 9.82%. So now, once again, the conclusion has to be that Jeju is as comprehensible to speakers of Korean as Norwegian is to speakers of Dutch. So Jeju and Korean are distinct languages to the extent that Norwegian and Dutch are distinct languages. If you want to argue that they're not, okay, that's, we'll give you an opportunity to tell that to Norwegians and to the Dutch. But the rates of comprehensibility here are strikingly similar for these two sets of related but distinct languages. So once again, the conclusion has to be that Jeju is indeed an independent language, and I think that could be helpful to the community in at least three ways. First, it'll help community members realize that Jeju is an independent language. It is not a substandard variety of Korean, contrary to what they have been told for decades. Second, and hopefully, this finding will help change the attitudes of people elsewhere in Korea and give them a new respect for the language of Jeju Island and help them realize that their country is actually home to more than one language, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. And finally, with the languagehood of Jejua established, we hope that it'll be easier to persuade the provincial and national governments to support efforts to preserve and revitalize it as part of the country's cultural heritage. Certainly, we desperately need that type of help. Hopefully, this will be one of those occasions in which linguists are actually listened to and are able to make a contribution to a country's social and cultural policy. Thank you very much.
Interest of time, I think I want to go to the Ryukyuan team's report. First, Takubo will talk about Ryukyuan team's attempt to continue the similar theme that William just described.
Okay, Ryukyuan, our situation is a little bit more complicated than our Korean and Jejuo. So for example, there are at least six languages in Ryukyu, which is a cognate language of Japanese. There is this proto-Japonic that's not proto-Japanese. It's called usually called proto-Japonic, including Japanese and Ryukyuan. The interesting thing, or to notice, that in Ryukyuan there are two varieties, major varieties, and under the two varieties of Northern Ryukyuan and Southern Korean, there is this three languages in Northern Ryukyuan and three languages in Southern Ryukyuan. Okay, so what we're planning to do is to do the same thing, the same kind of test, make the same kind of test, and get the results as were done by the Jeju team. And this study research is funded by a grant from our Toyota Foundation. So our project is inspired by and based on the Jeju project, and we did some pilot test which led to the modification and expansion of the original test as devised by the Jeju team. And we sort of introduced the term mutual intelligibility index, which is a very simple thing, you know, percentage of intelligibility divided by 100. So one is perfect understanding, zero is zero understanding. So instead of saying that some people understand Jeju 9%, we'll say that they understand 0.09 score in my index. And there are some differences or deviations from of our project from Professor O'Grady's team. There are the number of languages to be tested. We have to, as I was saying, there are five to six languages of Ryukyus, and we are going to include two or three languages of mainland Japan, which are sometimes known to be quite different from the standard Japanese. So we need better control of the test sentences to be used. And another thing is that we want to use this MI index to measure intergenerational transmission. So we have to, we're going to apply MI index to intergenerational transmission between different generations. So those are considerations led to some modification of the original experimental design by Professor Grady's team. So we want to introduce, we're planning to introduce another story, Pingu, in addition to Pear story. And we try to bring in some more statistical rigor by the help of a psychologist who is very well versed in statistics. And we need to have two independent tests for each group. I mean, a group of divided by region and divided by age. And we increased questions to 20 instead of 10. In order to avoid some vague answers to the questions. And that led to the addition of Pingu, because pair story is very good. It has some merits, like you can use the same story for multiple languages. You can use the same set of questions to be used for different languages, so that the result of the test can represent the same mutual intelligibility or MI index measure. And also, as you know, it's culture-free, and so free of cultural clues that are independent from languages to be tested, which is very important to avoid guessing on the part of the, you know, testees. But there are some merits, demerits in using a pair story, because each scene is very, very complex, and there are too many elements in a scene. So that might be cause for variations among speakers in making test sentences. It's sometimes very difficult to control. It allows for variations in the interpretation of test sentences. And another thing is that they have some cognates, which is incidental to the part that we use for test. There are proto-Japonic cognates that can easily be guessed, like tree, which is key in standard Japanese. And key in the test sentences in the Ryukyuan languages, which cannot be helped. And to fall is ochiru in standard Japanese, and uti in most of the Ryukyuan languages. Of course, this cannot be helped because they come from the same ancestor, Proto-Japonic, but they may not be a fair representation of the differences. And there are other things such as collocation. There are words that can be guessed without knowledge of the target language. So if you know what a tree is, if you recognize a word for tree, which is the same in both languages or set of languages, then you can easily access words related, associated with the word tree. So what can you do with a tree? You can either climb up or climb down, right? So without knowledge of the language, you can sometimes guess what is being talked about, which is not a good thing in making tests. So in the combination of 3 and 4 may heighten MI index without knowledge of the language tested. So we added Pingu story, which is somewhat ideal to the you know, purpose that we're going to be making the test. Then Masa will take over.
Some modification, just to sum up what he said. So there are two dimensions of expansion. One is the goal, and the other one is the method. But the goals, in addition to the interlanguage mutual intelligibility across languages, we also added the mutual intelligibility across the generations. So we want to know the intergenerational transmissions in addition to the differences between two islands or two locations. In order to do that, we had to change how to make the test and also the experiment design. Okay, so we'll come back to this picture later. Okay, so the first thing that we are interested in is the mutual intelligibility among sister languages, among the Ryukyuan languages, and among or between Japanese languages and Ryukyuan languages here. So we work with 13 people together. So we didn't add Manami here. 13 field workers plus one experimental psycholinguist. And try to answer the questions like, so do Yonaguni speakers understand Yaeyama? So they are from different islands. or do Aragusku Miyako speakers understand Ikema Miyako? So they live in the same island, Miyako, that's where he's from, but from different villages. Not that far, but sounds very different. Is it true that they are mutually intelligible or not? Okay. So that's the cross-language support. And we also want to know the intergenerational transmission, language transmission. So that's the very important criteria for assessing the language vitality. So people say that, oh, younger generations, like younger than like 40 years old, 50 years old, do not understand the local language. Is that true? Okay. Or more exactly, where in the generations does the intergenerational language transmission cease? So where is the point that we need to work on? Do we need to, like, is it true that the people in like 50s, 40s do not understand language? So if you want to like revitalize the language, we have to work the generations under that age. Or it might be true that those people in 50s or 40s, they might have passive knowledge of language. So we might have to do something different from what we do with like babies or kids. Who knows? So these reports, like younger generations do not speak the language, or the fluent speakers are above 60 years old, or if you go to the different village or different islands, the languages are not mutually communicable. Those reports are based on anecdotes or subjective judgments of the researchers or the speakers. We want to provide some objective understanding using the experiment here. So moving on to the expansion in terms of the test making. So the goals are like this. The tests in different languages, different locations, need to be as equal as possible so that we can compare the results. And also each episode and the whole narration, the narration of the whole story need to be sound as natural as possible. We want to make it just like someone describing situations and to someone else. And the results of each test are ideally statistically comparable. Okay, so we got together, 13 people got together, and we prepared the episode question answer pair in one language, namely Japanese, first. So for example, let's do this. Episode, listen. When the boy fell off the chair, all the dishes fell off the table. Question, what happened when the boy fell? Correct. Okay, and we do this for 20 episodes. So we do this, or we make this kind of episode like recordings in different locations. So for example, 男の子が椅子から落ちた時、テーブルの上のお皿が全て落ちました。 Question, what happened when the boy fell? Okay. Oh yeah, you got the point. So you got score 0 for the Japanese part. So Japanese and English are usually not communicable. Okay, so we prepared 20 episodes and question answer pairs, like model answer pair first, and then each member go to their field and make the test with the native speaker. So there are some text here, but that's too much, so I explain with this picture here. So one of the project member work with the native speaker watching a short movie, Pear Story and Pingu, and ask her or him to describe each scenes. So what's happening here? Tell me. What are they doing? Then we record them, or write them down first, and then record them, and make individual episodes and whole narrations, plus the questions for each episode, like the ones that we did. So that's the test. And then bring that to, so bring that test to different islands and run the experiment with the native speakers of different languages to see whether the test that we made in that island, to see the language spoken in that island is communicable with this island or not. So that's the cross-language part. And we can also use the same test, the same material, with the speakers or the people in the same island, but from the different generation. The subjects are from different generations. To see whether these generations, like from 40s, do they understand what the native speakers are saying or not, or much younger generations.
Okay. So pair theories are good, but pair theories are not good.
Okay. But namely, episodes are not so clear and hard to make episode sentences like equal episodes across languages. And also many cognate words and collocation appear, so not the best candidate, but we use it anyways. And we add another story to make an experiment anyways, so that's the Pingu. Do you know the Pingu? That's a just like 5 minutes stop motion clay animation for kids with not human languages. So Pingu is becoming right. So we pick up random one. So what's happening and who is doing in each situation or in each scene are very clear because it's targeting the children. So the episodes are very clear, so it's easy to describe in simple sentences in different languages. And also things happen, small things happen in the Pingu world, which is slightly different from human world. So again, like pair story, little cultural background supports guessing. And also many different stories are available, like 157 stories available. So if you want to expand this experiment, it's easy to do that with. So designs like this. So the factors are language and age. So we need at least two tests. One test in language one and another test in language two. And get the subject from one area and let them listen to the recordings or tests. First, probably, for example, for English speakers, the language one would be Japanese, so story one would be pair story. So you guys take the test in Japanese, do you understand these things? And then compare that to the language two made in English, and do that, and compare the difference between English and Japanese. Okay. But in our case, language one and language two would be from different Ryukyuan languages, and we do the baseline test in Japanese, so that the test itself is okay. Okay. Now, okay, first series of the test. So we are interested in mutual intelligibility across languages and across generations. We can keep going that. But after the experiment is done in one area or in one community, we cannot use it anymore. Right? Let's recycle it for educational purposes. So remember, there are like short movies like Pingu and Pear Stories. We get a set of whole episode narrations and transcription with annotations and also questions and answers of each episode in many different Ryukyuan languages. Right? And it's just 5 minutes short movie with narration and descriptions, annotations. And it's fun and cute if it's Pingu. So we can recycle this for educational purposes. That's a good material for language revitalization here. And the last thing, there is a limit. This is all about comprehension. This is a listening test, nothing about production. But the test or experiment is not designed to see how much the ability of the production of one language or some other language is. It's all about comprehension. Oh, that's it. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I'd like to open discussion. So any question to any part or any speaker in this panel, you're welcome to address to us.
This is just a short one about the Pingu things. Did you have any cases where somebody had already seen the Pingu video and so they knew what had happened because you were using something that may be popular media to start with?
Oh, maybe. But the Pingu was on only in the cable TV in Japan, I think.
Okay.
Not on the nationwide thing. Not in Okinawa anyway, so should be fine.
I think. How were the participants selected for taking these
If both, I guess, either.
We haven't done yet. We're still
maybe
making.
The pair stories.
So we had a situation where we had to use older speakers. I don't know if you noticed on the slide, but I think the speakers were between the ages of 49 and 60, because there just aren't that many fluent speakers of Jejua left. So the control group of Jejua speakers had to be in that age range. For that reason, because age matters in these sorts of experiments, we had to choose Mongol speakers of Korean who are also in that age range, at age 49 to 60.
Yeah, it seemed like a lot of the presentation had to do with differentiating between whether this is really a dialect or a language. But I was wondering, I was hoping to see more on, once that's discovered, is like how that bears on well-being and self-esteem. I didn't see that as much. Maybe more so in the Korean situation, but I didn't really hear as much maybe somebody could say something about how that affected the well-being of the Japanese also.
It's very difficult to understand how severely the language situation affected speakers of UQ1. As Mr. Nakama explained, when he was a schoolboy, you know, they have this punishment system. Although I was surprised that Professor Yang said that there was corporal punishment that was not very common. But from what we heard from villagers, the corporal punishment was very, very common in Okinawa. Not only the, you know, wearing the tag all day, but, you know, actual, you know, corporal punishment, you know, hitting, you know, twisting arms like that, very common. So I really don't know, because I'm not a psychologist, I really don't know how much that affect to younger speakers. And it's very difficult to make assessment right now because of, we don't, I mean, the, you know, speakers getting old and you know forgetting their true experience. Maybe they want to forget about, you know, these you know negative experience. So it's not always easy to get a true assessment of psychological effect. Oh, Shisa.
About a question about the experiment that with Jejuo language. So, at least numerically, the Seoul speakers scored higher than other areas, and I wonder if it's just something that would disappear if you collect more data, or do you think it's real? If it's real, can you speculate why?
So the difference was statistically significant for the number of participants we had. One suggestion that was made is it is due to the phonologist at UCLA, Korean phonologist Sana Jan, who observed that the prosody of Jejua is more similar to the prosody of Seoul than is the prosody of the variety of Korean spoken in Yasu or in Busan. So it's possible that that might have slightly elevated the comprehensibility, although it was still, don't forget, less than 10%.
Sure.
So that's the best idea I've heard so far. Stick with that for now, please.
I'm curious about what kind of revitalization efforts are being made right now for both groups, for the Ryukyuan languages and Jejuo. Is there any kind of implementation in the public schools or maybe private immersion schools or mentor-apprentice programs that are happening? And if not, then what ways are you looking at moving forward in revitalizing these languages?
I think think there are some attempts at you know, building an immersion type school in Okinawa for Uchinaguchi, but nothing like that has been, you know, thought of in other areas of Ryukyu. So Uchinaguchi has been becoming very popular nowadays, so there are many people who are trying to study and master the language. There are the attempts at some other areas are quite limited. You know, sometimes they set up our YouTube channel, but that sort of attempts are quite sporadic.
Masa-san, not you.
So the attempt, so I've been working on the revitalization of like four islands for like a couple of years. And we kind of gave up like talking to the local government anymore because it will take time. So we decided to, or some other people as well, decided to work on their own. So try to put like things without local government so that they will realize eventually, oh, this is something that we should. So at this moment, nothing is happening.
Yeah. I've made up a web homepage, and there are like seven to nine hours of recordings, which includes his talks. So you can Google Nakama or my name Stakubo, and you can find a lot of films. And I made those website for as a model, you know, for other languages, so that people can, you know, make you know, similar web pages in their own dialects or languages. So there are some, you know, sporadic attempt at revitalization or conservation in those languages and Ryukyus. But they're still, you know, sporadic.
Okay, I briefly talk about the situation of Jeju. Jeju is, you know, as I told you, yeah, the recognition of Jeju as an independent language or any other unique language is that there's some big there's big shift in the attitude of the local people and trying to focus on the local government and local people. There's a big, you know, that since, well, the Jeju registers at UNESCO 2010, you know, around 2010, there's a, you know, big shift and local people more, you know, interested in the preservation and, you know, also there's a big civic organization called, you know, Jeju Promotion, the Preservation Society in Jeju. They organizing, they try to document and try to, you know, educate the people there. And also the civic organization forced, is, you know, maybe sound a little bit awkward, but anyhow, they forced the local government to support in financially or to support their, you know, the teacher programs. Then, you know, civic organization run some teachers education programs, even though there's informal systems. Also, local governments try to support, you know, the local, the TV and, you know, radio station. You know, good news is that there's some very short clip. Every week, there are 10-minute clip of Jeju dramas, and, you know, every day, you know, 2 or 3 hours, you know, Jeju, the radio stations are broadcasting in Jeju. You know, even though I'm using Jeju, it's kind of the, you know, mixed language, bilingual, you know, Standard Korean and, you know, Jeju. Not pure Jeju is a little bit, you know, way to come, a little bit. Still, there's a good news then. Also, Ministry of Education, local Ministry of Education, try to run the after-school programs and, you know, two hours a week, and, you know, kids are learning the Jeju. It's a, you know, it's a really sharp contrast between when I grew up, you know, if I use Jeju, you know, I must meet the kind of registers. But these days, you know, education office, they try to encourage kids to use the JGO because the sharply losing their language. Also, I personally writing the kind of short the newspaper column in Jeju, there is a local newspapers, other than another authors also make a contribution to weekly Jeju essay to newspapers and etc. Then there's I'm trying to organizing some other the activity to take the real preserving the Jeju. Well, it's at the very beginning stage where I'll listen to all other the cases around the world, then maybe it's a better I can get a better ideas how to put into action when I back to Jeju. Thank you.
We've gone over time, but maybe there's one last question if there's any.
Can I just make a quick comment? I feel like the government kind of creates this myth to label minority languages as dialect, but I don't really see the direct causation of language classification to language devaluation. So I feel like it's more of the ideologies built around a certain group of people that's really demining how people feel about their languages. So probably what we need to do is kind of break down those ideologies instead of putting too much weight on the classification. So that's kind of my final note.
Yeah, in principle, you're right. The problem is that if the ideology is wed to the terminology, if it's not possible for cultural reasons to tease the two apart, then you get the situation that we have right now. So, if you're living in a country where you have a one language, one nation policy, and there are varieties of speech that seem not to fit with that ideology, then they have to be classified in a way that makes them irrelevant. And the way to do that is to say, oh, these are dialects, they're substandard dialects, they're unique dialects, they're divergent dialects. The problem is they're so divergent we can't even understand them. But you know what that means? That means they're actually different languages.
Fortunately, both Jeju and Okinawa are in a very nice location. It's a very attractive tourist location. So now, I think in both areas, people started to notice their unique culture. And we're hoping that that will help us people realize that their language is also unique, and so that we can start rebuild a mutual respect among Japanese and Korean people. So we are pessimistic to some extent, but there's some optimistic view shared by people who work on these languages. Okay, thank you very much. I think it's we went over time, and thank you very much for your participation.